environmentalism and caring for the earth and action and, you know, uplifting people who have been doing this and are doing this type of work is not new to KBO, you know. This is, whether it's weekly programs like Locus Focus, I mean, there are just so many ones that, like
the
you
bike
said,
show, the dirt bag.
Exactly, the dirt bag, yeah, and they kind of take this from different point of view, whether it's a food show, whether the food impact of this, what, you know, just like this pollution and this system that we're living under when it comes to environmentalism. I can't say that word for some reason.
I can never spell it, so I think together I can say it and you could spell it.
There you go. Well, what it does to us in all different aspects of life, from, you know, like how the height, like, you know, you got middle school that's gonna protesting
either polluted or bulldozed, depending on what they
decide
to do.
Yes, exactly. It's a lose-lose-lose situation.
Yeah.
But, and that's what I think makes KBO so special. It's not just these one days and one-offs. It's just really, it's our community. Yeah. So with that being said, we're going to wrap up. You can go to kboo.fm/give or kboo.fm/thegap. We'll be back next week. Have a good weekend.
Enjoy your Earth Day. Thank you.
Bye-bye. We run this.
Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, and this is our special Earth Day program, Keep Going, Keep Growing. Coming up, we'll hear from three Oregon nonprofits working to protect our natural environment.
Earth Day Oregon has partnered with dozens of environmental nonprofits this year to help them raise money. These nonprofits do work across Oregon. This includes Central Oregon, the fastest growing area in the state. Central Oregon is home to seemingly endless outdoor recreation opportunities, diverse wildlife, and farms sprinkled throughout the high desert. One nonprofit, Central Oregon Land Watch, aims to protect all this. We spoke to Caitlin Burford, the organization's communications and outreach manager, about the nonprofit's priorities and how they've changed as Central Oregon grows.
Central Oregon Land Watch has been around for 37 years, and we really in recent years have begun growing as an organization, partly because it's a reflection of what's happening in Central Oregon. As Central Oregon grows, there's more kind of pressures on the surrounding environment and waterways and growing and mounting concerns. So our organization has been growing to kind of meet those needs. And 37 years ago, the group began really focused on some timber thefts that were happening in the Metolius River Basin. So it began with our founder, Paul Dewey, really organizing a group in Sisters, Oregon, to speak out against some illegal logging along that protected watershed. And so that's an area that we've been working on for decades, kind of really began there in the deep forests along the Metolius River.
And how have the organization's priorities morphed since then?
Yeah, so what began kind of really focusing on wilderness and wildlands areas has evolved as community needs have evolved. Mm-hmm. So we have three different program areas. We have a rural lands program that really focuses on farmland and private forest land at the county level. We have a cities and towns program that really focuses on how cities throughout Central Oregon, including Bend, Redmond, Sisters, can grow sustainably. And we have a wildlands and water program that kind of look at federal landscapes, wilderness areas, and also how water is used in Central Oregon and tackle those things. But we really believe that we can kind of think big and stay close to home, really regionally focused on Central Oregon. So even though we kind of have our hands in a lot of different environmental issues, what kind of ties them all together is this place in this region. And these things need to work in tandem. Like, we can't work on water if we aren't also working on housing, and we can't work on farmlands if we aren't also looking at things like water and land protection. So yeah, it's this big kind of puzzle piece of pulling together all these various things that have dramatic impacts on Central Oregon.
Totally. I mean, how do you balance between all of those very wide-reaching priorities?
We have to be really values-driven, and that's part of any nonprofit, of just knowing how much you can do with a small team. Mm-hmm. And we do a lot, and a lot of that is just continually coming back to our values and asking, what are our ultimate goals, and where do we kind of spend our time? And it's always a balancing act, but comes down to this framework of our vision for Central Oregon 50 years from now, and do the things we get involved in build that future. So it really comes down to having a really strong vision for what we think Central Oregon can be.
Yeah. How would you describe that vision?
We know people love Central Oregon, and there's this sort of intangible ethos of this place that people love. And when you ask people what they love, or why they live here, or why they visit here, or want to live here someday, you know, you'll get a variety of answers. Things like water, open space, present wildlife, and also things like small towns or cities that are walkable and equitable and have good transportation options. And those are something that we hope 50 years from now, you can come to Central Oregon and be surrounded by these beautiful vistas and wilderness areas that are flourishing ecological habitats that support wildlife. And then we also hope that our cities and towns are surrounded by productive farmland where farmers can work and continue to produce local food, and that our cities and towns are these places where people really feel equity and community at the heart of those spaces. So people can live nearby where they work and play, and that people from across all backgrounds can really find a space in Central Oregon.
What additional challenges is your organization facing as Central Oregon expands so much?
Yeah, well, we, as the population grows, we see kind of increased pressure to develop certain areas, and we want to make sure that development is well planned and well thought out. And so, for example, rather than a sort of rush to build housing anywhere, we want to make sure that the housing really meets the needs of the community. So we want to make sure that housing is directed in residential centers where people live and where people have access to goods and services and schools and doctors, and also that it meets needs of the community's affordability standards, so that we aren't building, you know, luxury housing outside of towns that really caters towards a different type of demographic but doesn't necessarily meet the needs of people who live and work here. And we kind of see this rush to, we see increasing development applications on rural lands every day. And we know that that pressure really caters to housing that isn't helpful to the communities that live here and really threatens the farmland that we do have remaining in Oregon. So we hear from working farms and ranchers every day asking that we kind of continue to uphold Oregon's land use laws on protected farmland to make sure that it remains farmland for future generations. So that is definitely something that we see as an increasing challenge that will continue to happen. Just the pressure to develop the state's remaining farmland and making sure that we don't, and we can really protect that for a few food and farming future for all Oregonians.
And it sounds like equity is really, really woven throughout that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think you can do good work on environmental issues without centering equity at the heart of it. And that means that asking, you know, these things go hand in hand. Environmental issues often hurt low-income communities first and foremost. And if that's not central focus of things like a question of housing or a question of water, then you really kind of miss the forest for the trees.
Some of the latest flashpoints I saw were, yeah, the Skyline Forest and the mm-hmm. Thornburg Resort. Wondering if you could tell me a little bit about those two issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Thornburg Resort has been going on in this region for a long time, and this began over a decade ago when a destination resort was proposed for development near the Klein Buttes area. And we've been concerned about those development plans from the very beginning, primarily because of a number of issues, but primarily the rising concern we're seeing now is just the use of water in these really water-intensive developments. And we live in the high desert, and water is a precious resource for the farmers that live here, for the fish that need water to survive in the very ecosystems they rely on and the rivers. And we're kind of seeing a push to continue to allow for really water-intensive developments, whether they're artificial lakes for recreation or whether they're golf courses. And people are concerned. People have real experience of their wells running dry or their water getting turned off. And we think that there is a real growing concern about when and how any new water-intensive development gets approved. And so we are kind of rallying public support to express those concerns and make sure that our elected officials know that water should be used for its highest and best purposes. And so that's really a central issue relating to a lot of different types of development, but that we really see coming to light with the current proposed resort development out there. And so, yeah, we're rallying public comment to try and get folks to understand the issues. We know they're really complicated, and be able to know that they have a forum to speak up, because these areas are, you know, part of public interest, and we think that the more the public knows and the more they are involved is always a good outcome, or always leads to a better outcome.
Yeah. And then what about the Skyline Forest?
Yeah, so Skyline Forest is interesting. A lot of folks know where it is, but if you don't, it is a vast area of land, forested foothills between Bend and Sisters that lines the Three Sisters Wilderness in the Cascade Range. So if you are up anywhere in Bend and look out over towards the Three Sisters Wilderness, you're probably looking over Skyline Forest. And this is a place that is really beloved by locals and visitors. People spend time hiking out there and birding and mushroom foraging and just bike riding. It's a really, you know, beloved landscape. But what many people don't realize is that this is actually privately owned land. People assume that it's public land or that it's managed by the Forest Service for public access, but it isn't. It's owned by a private company, a private investment firm, and it's currently for sale. And so even though the current landowners have sort of allowed public access, that could change any day. And we really want to make sure that that space that's so precious for recreation and also precious for wildlife habitat really remains this intact landscape that is available to support wildlife, to support the clean water and streams and tributaries that flow through there, and be a place that's accessible for Central Oregonians to recreate and enjoy that close outdoor access. So our goal is to ultimately make sure that that forest remains conserved and protected for generations to come, and that we can really restore that ecosystem. But there's a risk, because that could change. And so we're continuing to try and get community input and buy-in to come up with a creative solution to permanently conserve this really beloved forest rather than lose it to private development or other risks that could affect it.
I really had never, I mean, you know, lived here most of my life, and I never heard it even be called the Skyline Forest. That's And yeah, that's the area I'm looking out at all the time.
The goal is to get people to kind of know and recognize the area. Because so many people love it. But then if you can't name it, you can't know where you're at. And you can't try to protect something that doesn't have that sense of place. And so, you know, by calling it Skyline Forest, people say, oh, yeah, I've been there before. And it really kind of conjures up the experience of being in that space.
Yeah. And yeah. Are there any other kind of flashpoint issues you want to bring attention to?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that we really focus on in our Cities and Towns program is really making sure that as Bend and Sisters and Redmond and other places inevitably grow, that we really think about our climate impact and how we can grow in a more carbon neutral and climate friendly way. And one of the best ways to do that is just to reduce the amount of time people need to spend in their car. And that's really important for equity. Lots of people don't have access to a reliable vehicle to access work, but as important as that is just the amount of emissions. And this is kind of an interesting statistic that I like, that currently in Oregon, transportation accounts for 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions. So it's the largest contributor to climate change in the state. And I think sometimes people gloss over how much transportation can really affect our like place in global climate issues, but it really does. And so one of the things we're trying to do is just make sure that we plan for cities and towns with the future in mind that can really reduce our emissions through transportation. So that's kind of a fun goal of ours, and just getting people to be able to commute quickly and easily and through alternative methods of transportation that are a little bit gentler on our planet. The entire state of Oregon is working on what's called the Climate Friendly and Equitable Communities Rulemaking Process. So we call it CFEC for short, but it's awesome. And it is a statewide goal to ultimately reduce carbon emissions at the statewide level. And the way they do that is through transforming Oregon cities and towns to be equitable, social, wonderful places to live where driving isn't required or the amount of driving time is reduced. So there's this statewide initiative right now that affects everything from housing to transportation networks to really help encourage these communities of the future. And we are outright supporting them, and we're trying to get people on board to write in and support this climate-friendly and equitable communities rulemaking process, because it has the potential to be really big and transformative for the entire state.
Audience in the Portland Metro will mostly be hearing this interview.
Yeah.
Why do you think the rest of the state and that audience in particular should be paying attention to what's happening in Central Oregon?
Well, we think people that live here obviously have a direct connection, but so many people that don't also have a connection to this place and want to see it sort of protected for future generations. And we have a supporter of our organization who has been financially supporting us for years, and he visited Central Oregon one time years ago and currently lives across the country. But because he felt such a connection to this place and wanted to make sure that it existed for decades into the future, he financially supports us every month. And I think that's a really exciting story that just shows that people can kind of protect the places that they love even if they don't live there. And I think that's a resounding feeling for people across Oregon and across the Pacific Northwest, is that these issues cascade, and things like water in the Deschutes River Basin where we live affects water quality in Portland, and things like the agricultural productivity of local food created here in Central Oregon goes to people throughout the state and throughout the region. And so we're all connected through things like climate, water, food, transportation, and I don't think there's a way to kind of avoid that. And so we think working locally has these ripple effects for visitors and residents alike.
And I'm wondering if you could, if there's anything you wanted to highlight from the recent legislation session, any bills that move forward that you were particularly excited about.
Yeah, we were really excited by some of the results from the most recent legislative short session. And we saw a couple of really good wins for wildlife. One bill that passed that we were really excited for was funding for the Wildlife Crossings Investment Act, which appropriates some funding for wildlife corridors and passages to basically be able to make it safely over roadways by funding things like crossings or bridges across roads for mule deer or elk herds, the sustainability of local wildlife populations just goes way up. And this is one of those things that we have a simple fix, and let's get funding for it. And there was some funding allocated for that this year, and so we're really excited to see more wildlife crossings across the state as things like traffic and roadways continue to be developed. We need to make sure that we're living in a way that is really conscious of the wildlife that have been on this landscape before us. And that bill was one of those. Another one that we saw passed was HB 4123. And that was a bill that was passed in order to fund a coordinated response to houselessness. And we know that cities and towns across Oregon are really facing a crisis in people being able to afford homes. And part of that means that many people experience houselessness on a daily basis. And we just realized that we need to pour resources into being able to coordinate resources to provide safety and security for people that need it. So that was another bill that we were really excited to see pass.
Totally. And I know, yeah, with Earth Day coming up, I know you're a part one of the nonprofits that people can donate to through Earth Day Oregon. Is there anything else you're doing for the day?
Yeah, well, we are going to actually go spend the day, our staff, to take some time outside and go work on a local farm and kind of actually get our hands in the soil. It's one thing to kind of talk about protecting farmland from behind a computer screen, but it's an important memory to actually go back and work on the farms themselves and remember that sort of why we do what we do. So that's what we're going to be doing as a staff. And we're also going to be tabling on Earth Day this Friday at Back Porch Coffee Roasters, which is a local Bend coffee shop. So if you're in the area, stop by Back Porch and we can chat issues. And during that day, Back Porch is also going to be donating 20% of all sales to our organization. So it's a fun way to grab a cup of coffee and also support the landscapes that we call home.
That was Caitlin Burford, the Communications and Outreach Manager at Central Oregon Land Watch, one of the organizations partnered with Earth Day Oregon this year. You can find more information about their work to create well-planned cities and protect wild open spaces at centraloregonlandwatch.org. This is Hannah Merzbach with KBOO News.
I'm sitting with Katya Reina, the program director of DPAVE, and Catherine Rose, its community engagement coordinator. We are all gradually coming to terms with the impact city life has had on the environment and our natural resources. What is the particular impact of too much asphalt?
There are a lot of pollutants that exist in our city, and even trash, microplastics and things like that, that would be entering the water system if they were just flowing straight from our streets into the rivers. And we live in, as you know, on two major rivers with a lot of other water sources in this area. And so for us to slow down the flow of water by adding in these permeable spaces, we're actually helping to mitigate and clean the water before it enters the rivers.
The concept of removing pavement is a pretty new one, I think, for most of us living in cities. And I'm wondering, what are some of the benefits that a community might see after a depaving project?
They can look forward to areas that don't get as hot, that don't feel as miserable to stand in on a hot day. They can look forward to less drainage issues on many sites. There's areas that are puddling or causing, you know, basement flooding or whatever. So it mitigates that. It also brings pollinators, bees, butterflies, birds. There's one site where suddenly little Pacific frogs started showing up again, and they hadn't been there in years. It's sort of like bringing back natural habitat to a place that's been not like that for decades.
Yeah, we work with landscape architects who do these design projects, and they really design beautiful, aesthetically appealing spaces. So it's not just like we're throwing plants in the ground. They're aesthetically appealing, and yeah.
Urban regreening definitely helps us fight climate change, but that's not all it fights. How does it help disenfranchised communities overcome some of the social and environmental injustices that they've historically faced?
So it really relates deeply to the environmental justice movement. You can trace directly how concrete and the existence of development impacts or relates to how communities are historically disenfranchised in urban space. In Portland, we've seen how redlining has changed where and determined the outcomes of different communities based on racist zoning codes that led to discrimination and displacement of communities of color in Portland. So a lot of those communities were displaced into less desirable parts of the city where the city was not planning for or integrating green space in the same way as they did in higher income, more privileged communities. And so through denying those communities of access to resources, such as like educational resources and green space, those areas are also where they often put large highways and roads and box stores and just less desirable kind of community spaces. And you can look at overlay heat maps of Portland and see how industrial areas and like highways such as like I-5, 205, 84 are heavily paved and are usually where these communities are displaced to. And the way solar radiation affects pavement is it ends up causing this heat island effect. And in those areas, it can be up to 10 degrees hotter than other parts of the city on any given day. So considering some of our historically, you know, overly heated summer days that we've been having, it's pretty significant how it really relates to environmental justice. And a lot of these spaces, you can see how on the west side, Forest Park and Markham Park and these larger green spaces are where wealthier Portlanders live. And so it's very deeply tied to the environmental justice movement.
How does DPAVE find its projects? Are people coming to you with ideas, or are you going out into the community with your own suggestions for improvement?
All of our projects really are community-driven and are driven by people coming to us, identifying a space and working with us directly to kind of reimagine what a paved area could be. We work with the community. We do community charrette-style input processes or surveys. So everything that we do is reflective of what people want. It's not us top down telling them what they need in their space.
I will say that we are shifting away from that in a sense, or just sort of evolving the way that we seek out projects, because we realize that while it's great to not have to solicit, that also means that we're very much limited to people that have heard of us. And so we're actually going to be conducting a community needs assessment this summer, hopefully this summer, where we intentionally are going to be interviewing and reaching out to communities and organizations that directly serve BIPOC communities in Portland and asking them, you know, like, do they have any sites that they think we should be looking at? And if they need anything from us in general. So sort of seeking them out rather than waiting for people to come to us. So we're working on that.
Are there any obstacles you face from local government or businesses in getting the projects approved or carried out successfully?
The only things that have really come up that have significantly slowed us down is that if we're building a nature play area at a really old school, which most of these schools are very old, it might trigger other things that need to be updated. So when you go pull a permit, they look up the whole site and they're like, well, actually this water meter is, you know, outdated. And our project is nowhere near that water meter, but because it's on that property, they have to bring everything up to code in order to issue any permit. So that did happen at a Powell Butte Elementary where they were like, you have to bring this up to code. And I was like, okay, well, I'll let them know, but like, we're not going to pay for that. Like, we don't have, you know, that's not in our scope. And same with like trash enclosures. It'll be like, oh, this trash enclosure is outdated. You need to make sure it's the seepage is doing this or that. And again, not related to our project, but it's just other things that come up. But yeah, with businesses, we don't actually work with a whole lot of businesses either. We've worked with a couple, and it's usually because they have some sort of mission that aligns with ours. For example, like the St. John's Food Share, they're providing a service for the community. Or we've worked with churches that also are like center points for community to gather. Or Plaza 122 that we did back in 2019, that's a community investment trust. And so it's very much about giving people back their property and like letting people be owners. So yeah, I think usually the businesses that do want us, it's because they their mission kind of aligns with ours, and like giving land back and giving more power back to the communities and letting people have a say in what goes on there. Yeah, but the only thing that we ever get pushback on is that people don't like to lose parking. So usually if we can convince folks that it A, won't affect parking, or B, you all have plenty of parking, it's actually double what the code says you need, which is often what the case is. Usually we can ease them into that, especially at schools. A lot of teachers rely on overflow parking. And so we usually sometimes have to rely on city code to say, like, actually, you know, you only need 60 spots and you have 100, so you can lose 10. It's going to be okay.
What's the timeline for an average DPave project? Is it something that can be accomplished in a handful of weeks, or is it a much longer process?
It's always a little different, but typically for a bigger project, we'll go visit it and kind of do a site walkthrough and see what we can do. And then depending on the level of engagement that they're needing, like if they want to do a community outreach process, that can take, you know, a few months. If we're doing community outreach process and then we're going to have a designer work on it, that takes a little longer. So it can be from like a first site visit to the actual being done, it can be about a year to a year and a half. But once we depave, it's usually, if everything goes well, it's only a few months of construction. So I guess, yeah, roughly a year, year and a half. But it really depends on the size of the project and like the scope of like what they're trying to build. Because if it's just tree wells, that's really easy. You know, that doesn't take very long. But if you're trying to do a big nature playground, you know, where we're engaging kids and asking what they want, that process just takes a little longer.
What happens with all of the concrete and asphalt that gets broken up during these projects? Does it just get thrown away?
So there's a couple of things that can be done. Asphalt can be reused to resurface roads and make parking lots. Concrete can be actually repurposed to as something called urbanite, which is when it's reused and people will make retaining walls or structures. We actually recently had a group from France reach out to us who want to work with us around depaving a space there in their community. And they already had showed us, before they even reached out to us, they had a whole design plan, which was pretty amazing. And that included repurposing their concrete into a bench system around the space. So that's exciting to see. And it can be reused.
Yeah, and we've had some of the haulers we work with, like the dump folks, they actually will take it and reuse it for their lots because they have such heavy machinery that they like erode their ways all the time. And so they'll actually just take it for themselves.
I'd like to give you the chance to brag about some of your projects. Are there any that stand out for you?
I am really proud of Powell Butte Elementary. It's just the project I've been working on since 2019. And it, was, you know, the day that we finally brought soil in to plant everything was the day everything shut down for the pandemic. So it was just really hard to, you know, it was hard for everybody in every sense that day and that week. But we had to sort of be really creative and shift the way we do things. We used to really rely on volunteers and donations. And we had to shift and ask for more money and just do more contract work. And with that, we were able to really focus in on our workforce development, the aspect of workforce development in our work, which was really cool. But yeah, I think Powell Butte was really neat because I saw all different types of people come out and help. So we had different contractors that donated time to install boulders or to do some concrete pouring. We had a contractor that built almost everything, but he even donated some of his time to help with planting. We had at least 5 or 6 different volunteer groups that came out to do planting days, including some high schoolers. So it was just kind of nice to see different types of groups with, you know, different ages, different demographics come out. And it also, the mural that was built there, that was painted there, there was a whole community outreach process just for the mural, where the kids' faces are actually on there. And so they can see themselves reflected, you know, in their own space. So I just think it was a really, it's definitely one of the more beautiful sites. It's one of the larger projects. And it also, I think, encapsulates sort of everything we'd like in a project in terms of like community involvement and community empowerment.
What kind of support does DPAVE need most?
I think always donations are helpful. We rely completely on local grant funding and donations. Most of our local grants fund direct project expenses, and they're pretty particular about what we can cover with those grants. So it's usually things more traditionally considered like environmental, so plants and things like that. But if we want to put up a mural, or you know, build a futsal court, or put in you know fun interactive musical instruments, those we really need donations. So we have been trying to seek out donations from you know bigger foundations and bigger corporations that have that kind of money. So we're always looking for donations like that, and then yeah, volunteering. We're finally have volunteers again. It was kind of off for a little bit, but we're starting to do volunteer events again, and Catherine's you know managing a lot of those events. So if you're interested in volunteering, definitely reach out to us and we can add you to our volunteer listserv. We don't spam very much. We'll just send you when we have events going on, and we always have signups for those events. So
speaking of which, you guys have a lot of cool projects and events coming up. Are there any that you'd like to share?
We have two events on April 23rd that are part of our Earth Day Oregon campaign. We have a volunteer event at Powell Butte Elementary, the school that Katya just mentioned, and we still are looking for more volunteers for that. It'll be a weeding maintenance day, so it'll be an opportunity for people to just come and spend time in this space and see the plants. And
so that's Saturday, April 23rd from 10 to 2. And then afterwards, we're going to have a little beer gathering from 4 to 7 at Beer Bus. And part of the proceeds of the beer sales will go to support our organization. So that's a big day on Saturday, April 23rd. And then we also, grand opening ribbon cutting ceremony for this site that we keep talking about, Powell Butte Elementary. Since it's been such a long project, we wanted to kind of take a moment to celebrate that it's done and it's ready for kids to play at. And I think the kids are so used to seeing it under construction that they don't always even know that they can go there now. So we want to signal that it's open and signal that it's time to celebrate. So that will be on June 3rd, which is a Friday, and it will be at 3:30 p.m. So like right after school. And we're inviting pretty much anybody that had to do with the project. So all the school staff, students, parents, anybody that was a volunteer, any of the contract workers, project funders are all invited to come out. And yeah, we're just going to say a few words about the project and then let the kids play. So we're really excited.
The beer event is at Pod 28, which is a food truck pod on 28th and Burnside, essentially. And it'll be at the Captured Beer Bus. It's a percentage of proceeds will go to DPAVE, and there will be merchandise for sale and information about the organization. So hope that folks come hang out with us.
Volunteering with DPAVE sounds like a lot of fun. Can the whole family come out to help?
That's the plan. Theoretically, any person can DPAVE. There's a role for everyone at the events. So we encourage families to come and everyone to come out. So.
Yeah, we've had little kids out there. We're able to make some of the pavement pieces smaller so kids can pick them up and carry them over by hand. And we've had older folks who either help us, you know, run the sign in or help, you know, go pick up lunch, whatever. You know, there's always a role for everybody. And I would say if anybody is concerned about that, definitely reach out to us and let us know what your constraints are or what your strengths are and what you'd like to plug in for. And we can always accommodate anybody that wants to be a part of any project.
How can people reach you if they have any questions or just want to connect and see what you're all about?
Yeah, we're at DPAVEPDX on Instagram and Twitter, and we have a Facebook page as well. Give us a follow. We've got some updates about events coming up and just our project work. Our Instagram is probably our most active, most reflective of our work.
Awesome. Yep. Check them out. And Katya, Catherine, do you guys have any final thoughts you'd like to share with KBOO's listeners?
Yeah, I can share a little bit. We are doing a crew leader training where we're training our volunteer leaders. That's going to be on May 7th. So if you're interested in being a volunteer leader, definitely reach out to us. There's so many things. And that's going to be at Peninsula Elementary. It's a pretty small deep pave. We're expanding some tree wells and hopefully making another small planting area for them. And then our next big deep pave after that is at Patrick Lynch Elementary, which is in the Centennial School District. I believe that's scheduled for July 16th. Things always move, so always check. But right now it's scheduled for July 16th. All our events are usually on Saturdays. They're usually from 10 to 2. So that's our next big one. Would love to have as many people out there as possible. It's going to be probably on the larger side, so we're going to need a lot of folks. And we will be depaving over in Gresham as well. We don't have a date for that yet, but we are working with NARA over there. And we're going to be depaving a massive parking lot to make way for a healing garden and ceremonial space for the Native community over there. So yeah, those are some of our more like sooner projects, but we'll have many more than that as soon as we figure out what our next kind of, once we do the community needs assessment, we'll know where else we were going to go.
I'll also say one last plug in new future projects is we're working on our first right-of-way project at the 7th Southeast 7th and Sandy intersection in inner Southeast Portland. And that's a really exciting project because we're working for the first time in the right-of-way, actually removing part of the street. And we're working directly with PBOT and the Bureau of Environmental Services to kind of reimagine that crosswalk and bike crossing area. And so we actually have a community input process that is starting. And so folks should look out for a survey where they can give feedback to some of our design concepts, which hopefully that project will increase the safety and just livability of the inner Central East Side district. So, I mean, I guess I would just say shout out to all of the organizations and groups that work with us. I think coming into this organization as a new employee, I'm constantly just overwhelmed by how many connections we have and how supportive people are from the individual level to the business level to the like organizational level. And we're just grateful for everyone who's been able to help us along our journey.
And I'm sure I'm not alone in saying that I can't wait to see where else Deep Pave goes. Yay. Catherine and Katya, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Katya Reyna is DPAVE's program director and Catherine Rose is its community engagement coordinator. For KBOO News, I'm Bronwyn Clark.
The Street Trust is a local organization working to expand access to transportation choices in Oregon and to reduce dependency on single occupancy vehicles. In preparation for Earth Day, I spoke to the Street Trust's Grants and Impact Manager, Henry Miller, about what it looks like to create safer, more equitable access to street use.
Yes. Hi, I am Henry Miller. I'm the Grants and Impact Manager at the Street Trust, which is a regional transportation advocate that advocates for multimodal transportation options that prioritize safety, accessibility, equity, and climate justice in the Portland Metro.
Cool. So what is multimodal transportation?
Yeah, so when our organization was founded in the early 90s, we were the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And as you can tell by the name, we were mostly focused on bicycles. Bicycle infrastructure, community rides, and making it easier to bike in the city of Portland. In 2016, we transitioned to the Street Trust, and a big part of that was focusing on the multimodal part. So multimodal means pretty much everything apart from single occupancy vehicle travel. So bikes, pedestrians, transit riders, scooters, just a mix of everything. And the focus switched from being strictly, we need to make it easier to bike in this region, to more of a focus on, we need to make our region's transportation system more balanced, lower carbon, safer, healthier, more accessible, all that good stuff.
So how did that name change and that switch of focus come about?
Yeah, I unfortunately I wasn't there when the name was chosen, so I probably can't comment on that. But you know, I think in the last 30 years, there's just been a growing awareness among bike transportation advocates, but also transportation advocates in general, that in order to have a safer, healthier transportation system, we need more folks working together. And a part of that realization was that, you know, historically speaking, biking in the Portland region is seen as a very middle-aged white guy thing to do. And I'm trying to recognize that not everybody has the same needs, not everybody feels comfortable riding a bicycle, and for very good reason. You know, there's been research put out by Portland State University about walking while Black, where it is more dangerous to cross the street if you're a person of color. And the same thing applies to people who ride bicycles. And of course, it's not just who's driving around you, it's also where you're biking, where you're walking, where you're using transit, because the most dangerous places to do all of those things tend to be concentrated in communities of color, low-income communities, especially in East Portland. So, you know, the last 25 years, our organization, but I think just advocates in general, have started to come around to the idea that we need to be working with everyone and really prioritizing the folks that are losing out the most from the current system of transportation.
Yeah, I'm curious, what's your personal interest in this organization and this work? I mean, besides it being your job, of course.
Yeah, I've heard of it being my job. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Portland, and as a kid, I was in a very bike-friendly household, and my dad used to take me on rides along the waterfront all the time. And, you know, especially in the 90s, I think the idea that Portland was going to become this bike mecca was really hot at the time. And so I always saw it that way. And then I left home and came back, and a lot of the infrastructure was still great for me. But I noticed that, you know, it's concentrated in a few areas. It's not something that everybody can use, and it's not something that everybody is universally supportive of. And again, for good reasons, it's typically seen as something that middle-aged white guys mostly do. So, you know, as something that is something that I cared about a lot as a kid, biking in Portland, wanting to see that become more inclusive, more widely spread across the entire region.
So do you like to bike now?
I do. I bike everywhere. So I used to own a bike, or I still do, but I don't use it anymore because I've been using Biketown for like the last 2 years to get everywhere I go. And if someone hasn't tried using Biketown, I used to work for them as well, so I got free rides, which was definitely an incentive. But since I stopped working for them, they made them all electric. And if anyone hasn't tried riding one of these electric bikes, it is a crazy different experience than a normal pedal bike. You really feel like you can go anywhere. And also in the last couple of years, PBOT, to their credit, has installed a lot of new bike infrastructure. I live in Northwest Portland, and there's a new bike bridge that goes across 405. And just having that bridge and a couple of greenways, I can bike from, you know, my neighborhood in Northwest to deep Southeast to, you know, the 50s to 82nd in, like, I don't want to say like 35, 40 minutes on an electric bike, and almost without breaking a sweat. It's pretty awesome.
That sounds really fun. I've been meaning to try those.
Yeah, you totally should.
So what, besides bikes, you know, what are some of the other options for multimodal travel?
So multimodal, yeah, it's everything. And it's a category that keeps getting bigger year after year because there's been so many great inventions that have come onto the market. So it is electric scooters, but I don't know if folks have seen those like single-wheeled skateboards with like the single fat wheel. They're very confusing to me. I don't know how physically they work, but that definitely counts as something. And then also transit is a huge part of multimodal. So, you know, our transit system, it's pretty robust. It has a lot of improvements that need to be made. One thing that I think we're at the Street Trust very excited about is the Rose Lane project. And folks might have seen that more recently. It's when they essentially make bus-only lanes. They paint the street red, and so private vehicles can't drive on them. And that just speeds up transit times. It means that if you ride a bus, you're less likely to get stuck in traffic. So, you know, transit, it's got a long ways to go in Portland, to be honest. And as long as our transportation agencies and our state DOT keeps on investing in highway infrastructure, it's always going to have to compete extra hard in order to be more viable for folks who would be able to drive otherwise. But at the same time, we are making investments, and there are things like the Tillicum Crossing Bridge and the Rose Lane Project that do show some real promise and some commitment from our city.
Yeah, those are really cool. I've seen those lanes popping up. Can you give like a broad overview of what bikes and other carbon-free transit options do for our environment?
Oh, yeah. Well, so the first thing to point out is that 40% of Oregon's emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, comes from the transportation sector. And about 63% of those emissions are from privately owned vehicles, so passenger trucks, passenger cars. So driving a car, it does a lot. It produces a lot of emissions.
If you live in most areas within the city of Portland, Henry says, you have access to some of our state's best bicycle, pedestrian, and transit system infrastructure. Like TriMet, more access to money for pedestrian sidewalks and bike lanes.
So, you know, I think this region has a responsibility as people who are getting the most investment in their in our bike lanes and our transit systems. We have a responsibility to figure out how can we reduce the amount of single occupancy vehicle driving time that we do. Even if you're not completely giving up your car, even if you're, you know, using your car to drop your kids off at school because their school is far away, or you have a lot of kids, even if you're using it to get big grocery trips, using alternative modes to replace other trips like trips to the corner store or smaller trips to the grocery store, or encouraging your kids to bike some days of the week when it's not rainy, biking to work, using transit, all that stuff can have a really big impact on not just like reducing global emissions. It's very hard to feel like you have an impact on global emissions just by not driving, but it also encourages our local government and transit agencies to invest more in improving that experience. The more people bike, the easier it is for PBOT to justify, okay, well, we need to install more bike lanes here because people actually want to do that. So it's really about building that critical mass to improve our local transportation system to make it better for everyone who is trying to not drive as much.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I hadn't really thought of that aspect of choosing to bike sometimes or choosing other transit modes.
Or walking, or pretty much anything. Sometimes it's just like changing which destinations you're trying to get to. Do you really need to go to a supermarket in order to get everything that you're going to be eating for the next 5 days? Or can you go to like a smaller grocery store that's nearby? It's making like those little small decisions that can have a really big impact over a long time frame.
I asked Henry what projects the Street Trust has been involved in lately. And he told me that the pandemic has prompted people to start thinking differently about what their neighborhood and their streets mean to them.
And so there's been a lot of new interest in improving pedestrian infrastructure and making our streets safer, even as traffic fatalities keep going up.
Addressing street safety issues like traffic fatalities has been a big part of the Street Trust's work. Some of their other current projects are targeted towards creating safe environments for bikers. And they're also working to make sure people driving cars know how to keep themselves and others safe.
So a lot of the projects that we've always been committed to, the things that we always have loved doing, safe routes to school, We Bike Portland, which is like a community bike ride for women and trans folks, those things are becoming more popular. We also have a bunch of bike commuter and bike safety clinics, legal clinics, so people know what is the law when it comes to biking around their neighborhood so that it's safer for them.
Are there any laws that like stick out that you know of that you think, oh, people should really know this, that they, you know, they have this right when they're biking or...
Yeah, so in Oregon, cyclists have a rolling stop law, which means that you don't have to stop at every stop sign. You can roll through if there's no traffic coming in the opposite directions. And if you've ever ridden a pedal bike through a city street, you know how big of a deal that is, because it is pretty exhausting to have to stop at every intersection and get started again. And for some folks who might think that that seems like, oh, that's kind of unsafe, it's worth remembering that our entire street system was retrofitted and redesigned strictly to service cars and stop lights and stop signs. A lot of those are just about making it so the cars kill fewer people, and they still kill quite a few people. So cyclists being able to do a roll stop through an intersection, it saves a lot of energy. It makes it easier and less intimidating. When you know that there's no cars coming, it makes it easier to bike longer distances. So that's really important. It's definitely a big convenience factor. And it's kind of a sign of what it looks like when you start reconfiguring our transportation system to make it easier for people to choose other modes rather than design everything around the fact that cars are very dangerous.
Yeah, it sounds like that's the sort of thing that everyone should know that that law passed, you know, yeah, not just bicyclists. Yeah. Okay, so you've told me about a bunch of projects. I'm just curious if there's anything that sticks out in your mind, like what are some of the most exciting things happening around bike transit safety and accessibility?
Oh, man. Like I said, there is a lot of stuff happening right now. It's a very exciting time for transportation, just in general. E-bikes are becoming more popular. E-bikes are really exciting because it takes away a lot of the intimidation and exhaust factor of biking. They are still much more carbon neutral than building, you know, a one-ton vehicle and driving a car around. But they can also carry things like groceries more easily, kids on the back more easily, and we've just been seeing a lot more interest in them. And I think something that folks think about is checking out Tigard's Move for May project, which is offering free e-bike and scooter demos at farmers markets and trails in Tigard this May. So that's an exciting example of cities kind of recognizing how impactful this tool could be and trying to embrace it, encourage folks to use it. Let's see. In Portland, there's the city is making the the Healthy Businesses permit permanent, which is really awesome. The Healthy Businesses and Public Plazas programs, that's what has allowed the different restaurants during the pandemic to set up sidewalk cafes in the actual street. And I've written about this before. Portland has had a very successful program. Back in November, the city of Portland did a survey. They tried to see, you know, how popular have these outdoor dining areas been, and they found pretty much universal love for these seating areas. So everybody seems to like it. They are helping businesses stay open during one of the toughest crises in our city's history, and they're also really great for encouraging people to not drive to their favorite local restaurant or cafe and instead take a bike or walk. The city found that a significant majority of folks who had visited these places that have outdoor dining areas, a lot of them have been walking. So that's a pretty big deal. And again, it's all about, you know, our city's landscape has been retrofitted to serve cars primarily. And it's come at a massive cost in a lot of different ways. But it's just kind of fascinating how these very small changes, like having a permit that allows you to set up a dining area in a car parking space, like that would have been very difficult before the pandemic. And yet it's only, you know, it's a couple of chairs and some tents or an overhang. And all of a sudden you've transformed the street and you've made it more of a pedestrian area and you've served the businesses as well as the customers. So that's a very exciting thing.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So what can folks do if they want to support and get involved?
Well, first thing I should do is promote the Move for Mother Earth Marathon, which is happening this weekend. It's a walk, roll, jog, and run event starting at the Leif Erikson Trail in Forest Park. It's Sunday, April 24th at 10 a.m. It's a $10 entry fee, although kids and maybe just as important dogs enter for free. Afterwards, there's going to be a little party. So I definitely encourage folks to attend that.
Great. That sounds really fun.
Yeah. So if folks want to get involved, they can check out our website, thestreettrust.org. If they want to donate to us and all of our activities that promote a more sustainable, carbon neutral, carbon free environment, or they can visit one of the three businesses that has decided to sponsor us this year, that being Legwork Local Delivery, which provides 100% zero emissions local delivery service in the city of Portland. You can visit Nosa Familia, which is a really delicious coffee shop that has, I believe, three locations in the city of Portland, in the downtown area. Or you can check out Bevo Portland, which sells stainless steel water bottles designed for athletes, including cyclists. And then lastly, we have the summit, the Oregon Active Transportation Summit, which is happening next week. Oh my goodness, it's coming up. So each year, the summit hosts hundreds of professionals and advocates from Oregon and Southwest Washington to discuss cutting-edge transportation issues. We have keynote speakers, Lynn Peterson, the Metro Council president, is going to be speaking. And let's see, this year, the guiding theme for the 2022 summit is Our Transportation Future. Tickets are on sale now. You can find out more about the summit at our website, which is streettrust.org. It's starting April 25th through April 27th. And yeah, you can buy your tickets through our website.
Cool.
The last thing Henry wanted to impart on KABU listeners is that if you've been thinking about transit advocacy and climate justice, now's the perfect time to get involved in that work.
Everybody is aware that we've been in an unprecedented couple of years in terms of, you know, how people's lives are defined by the pandemic. It's been really tough, but there are now way more people that are interested in things like climate change and sustainability, and making it easier for folks to detach their lives from cars, which are a very damaging vehicle that we use for the environment. So if you're looking, if you've always wondered, like, I want to get involved,